Chapter 5. Just as he recognized them for what they were. In the eyes of God, all men and women are naked. Clothes are nothing more than a fig leaf, and the bodies beneath are just another layer of clothing, an outfit of flesh with an impractically thin leather exterior, in various shades of pink, yellow, and brown. The souls alone are real. Seen in this way, there can never be any such thing as social unease or shyness or embarrassment. All you need do is greet your fellow soul. At Peter's greeting, Stanko set the bottles to rights, looked up and grinned. The Chinese guy gave a thumbs-up salute, and the woman who'd been dozing with her eyes open unfortunately got a fright and jerked her legs, spilling coffee into her lap. "Oh my!" cried Peter, and rushed over to her. "I'm so sorry." She was wide awake now. She had on a loose smock and pants, much like Granger's, but beige. The spilled liquid added a large brown blotch.
It's okay," she said. "It wasn't that hot."
An object flew past Peter's face, landing on the woman's knee. It was a tea towel tossed by Stanko. Calmly, she began to swab and dab. She lifted the hem of her dress, revealing two damp patches on her gauzy cotton slacks. "Can I help?" said Peter. She laughed.
"I don't think so."
"My wife uses vinegar on coffee stains," he said, keeping his eyes on her face so that she wouldn't think he was ogling her thighs.
"This isn't real coffee," the woman said. "Don't worry about it."
She balled up the tea towel and placed it on the table in an unhurried, methodical motion. Then she settled back into her chair, apparently in no rush to change. The jazz music lapsed into silence for a moment. Then the cymbals and snare drum were tickled by a pair of brushes. The saxophone exhaled, and the noodling began once more. Stanko busied himself with something tactfully noisy, and the Chinese guy studied his magazine. Bless them, they were trying to give him space. "Have I blown my chance to introduce myself?" he said. "I'm Peter. Moro. Pleased to meet you." The woman extended her right hand. He hesitated before shaking it, having noticed that one of her fingers ended at a knuckle stub, and her pinky was missing altogether. He took hold, and she squeezed, confidently. "You know, that's very unusual," he said, sitting down next to her.
"Factory accident," she said.
"Happens every day." "No, I meant the way you offered me that hand. I've met lots of people with fingers missing from their right hand. They always offer the left one for a handshake, because they don't want to make the other person feel uncomfortable." She seemed mildly surprised. "Is that a fact?" Then she smiled and shook her head as if to say, "Some people sure are weird." Her gaze was direct and yet guarded, examining him for identifiers that could be logged in the as-yet-empty file labeled Missionary from England. "I just went out for a walk," he said, gesturing at the darkness outside. "My first time."
"Not much to see," she said.
"Well, it is night," he said.
"Even in daylight, there's not much to see, but we're working on that."
She didn't sound proud or offhand, just descriptive. "What's your job here?"
"Engineering technologist."
He allowed himself to look bemused, signaling, "Please explain." She parried with a look that signaled, "It's late and I'm tired."
"Also," she said, "I do some work in the kitchens, cooking and baking, every 96 hours.
She raked her fingers through her hair. There were grey roots under the glossy black and orange.
"That's kind of fun. I look forward to that."
"Volunteer work?"
"No, it's all part of my schedule. You'll find a lot of us have more than one function here."
She stood up. It wasn't until she extended her hand again that Peter realized their encounter was over.
"I'd better get cleaned up," she explained.
"Nice to have met you, Moro," he said.
"Likewise," she said,
and walked out.
"Makes good dim sum parcels," said the Chinese man when she'd gone.
"Excuse me," said Peter.
"Dim sum pastry is a difficult thing," said the Chinese man. "It's fragile, the dough. But it's got to be thin, or it's not dim sum. Tricky. but she's good at it. We can always tell when she's been on kitchen duty.
Peter moved to a vacant chair next to the Chinese man.
I'm Peter, he said.
Werner, said the Chinese man. His hand was five-fingered and pudgy, and exerted a carefully measured firmness in the handshake.
So you've been exploring?
Not much yet. I'm still very tired. Just got here.
Takes a while to adjust. Those molecules in you gotta calm down.
When's your first shift?
I don't really...
I'm here as a pastor. I suppose I expect to be on duty all the time.
Werner nodded, but there was a hint of bemusement on his face, as though Peter had just confessed to signing a shonky contract without proper legal advice.
Doing God's work is a privilege and a joy, said Peter. I don't need any breaks from it.
Werner nodded again. Peter noted at a glance that the magazine he'd been reading was Pneumatics and Hydraulics Informatics, with a full-color cover photo of machine innards and the snappy headline, Making Gear Pumps More Versatile.
This pasta thing, said Werner. What are you going to be doing exactly?
On a day-to-day basis.
Peter smiled.
I'll have to wait and see.
See how the land lays, suggested Werner.
Exactly, said Peter.
Tiredness was swamping him again. He felt as if he might pass out right there in his chair, slide onto the floor for Stanko to mop up.
I gotta admit, said Werner, I don't know much about religion.
And I don't know much about pneumatics and hydraulics, said Peter.
Not my line either, said Werner,
reaching over with some effort to replace the magazine in the racks. I just picked it up out of curiosity. He faced Peter again. There was something he wanted to clarify.
China didn't even have religion for a long time, under like one of the dynasties.
What dynasty was that?
For some reason, the word Tokugawa popped into Peter's mind. But then he realized he was confusing Japanese and Chinese history.
The Mao dynasty, said Werner.
It was bad, man. People getting killed left, right, and center. Then things loosened up. People could do what they liked. If you wanted to believe in God, fine. Buddha too. Shinto. Whatever.
What about you? Were you ever interested in any faith?
Werner peered up at the ceiling. I read this huge book once. Must have been 400 pages. Scientology. Interesting. Food for thought.
Oh, B, thought Peter. I need you here by my side.
You gotta understand, Werner went on. I've read a lot of books. I learn words from them. Vocabulary building. So if I ever come across a weird word one day, in a situation where it matters, I'm, like, ready for it.
The saxophone hazarded a squawk that might almost have been considered raucous, but immediately resolved itself into sweet melody.
There are lots of Christians in China nowadays, Peter observed. Millions.
Yeah, but out of the total population, it's like 1%. Half of 1%, whatever.
Growing up, I hardly ever met one.
Exotic. Peter drew a deep breath, fighting nausea. He hoped he was only imagining the sensation in his head, of his brain shifting position, adjusting its fit against the lubricated shell of his skull.
The Chinese are very focused on family, yes?
Werner looked pensive.
So they say.
Not you?
I was fostered to a German military couple based in Chengdu. Then when I was 14, they moved to Singapore.
He paused. Then in case there might be doubt, he added,
with me.
That must be a very unusual story for China.
I couldn't give you stats, but yeah, very unusual, I'm sure.
Nice folks, too.
How do they feel about you being here?
They died, said Werner, with no change of expression. Not long before I was selected.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Werner nodded, to confirm agreement that his step-parents' demise was, in the final analysis, a regrettable event.
They were good folks. Supportive.
A lot of the guys here didn't have that. I had that. Lucky.
Are you in touch with anyone else back home?
There's a lot of folks I'd like to touch base with. Fine people.
Any one special person?
Werner shrugged.
I wouldn't rate them one over the other. All unique, you know, talented. Some of them I really owe. Like, they helped me, gave me pointers, introduced me to opportunities. His eyes went glassy as he reconnected momentarily with a distant past. When do you go back? Said Peter. Go back? Werner took a second or two to decode the question, as though Peter had voiced it in an impenetrably thick accent. Nothing scheduled for the foreseeable. Some guys, like Severin, for instance, have been back and forth every few years. I'm like, why? It takes you 3-4 years to hit your stride. Acclimatization-wise, expertise-wise, focus-wise, it's a big project. After a while, you get to the point where you can see how everything joins up with everything else, how the work of an engineer ties in with the work of a plumber and an electrician and a cook and a horticulturalist. His pudgy hands cupped an invisible sphere to indicate some sort of holistic concept. Suddenly, Werner's hands appeared to swell in size, each finger ballooning to the thickness of a baby's arm. His face changed shape too, sprouting multiple eyes and mouths that swarmed loose from the flesh and swirled around the room. Then something hit Peter smack on the forehead. It was the floor. A few seconds or minutes later, strong hands hooked under his shoulders and heaved him onto his back. Are you okay? Said Stanko, strangely unfazed by the delirious seesawing of the walls and ceiling all around him. Werner, whose face and hands were back to normal, was likewise unaware of any problem, except the problem of a sweat-soaked, foolishly overdressed missionary sprawled insensible on the floor. Are you with us, bro? Peter blinked hard. The room turned slower. I'm with you. You need to be in bed, said Stanko. I think you're right, said Peter. But I don't know where... It'll be in the directory, said Stanko, and went off to check. Within 60 seconds, Peter was being carried out of the mess hall and into the dim blue corridor by Stanko and Werner. Neither man was as strong as BG, so they made slow and lurching progress, pausing every few meters to adjust their grip. Stanko's bony fingers dug into Peter's armpits and shoulders, sure to leave bruises, while Werner had the easy job, the ankles. I can walk, said Peter. But he wasn't sure if that was true, and his two Samaritans ignored him anyway. In any case, his quarters weren't far from the mess hall. Before he knew it, he was being laid down, or rather dumped, on his bed. Nice talking with you, said Werner, panting slightly. Good luck with... whatever. Just close your eyes and relax, bro, advised Stanko, already halfway to the door. Sleep it off. Sleep it off. These were words he'd heard many times before in his life. He had even heard them spoken by men who'd scooped him off a floor and carried him away, although usually to a dumping place much less pleasant than a bed. On occasion, the guys who'd lugged him out of the nightclubs and other drinking holes where he disgraced himself had given him a few kicks in the ribs before hoisting him up. Once, they tossed him into a back street, and a delivery van had passed right over him, its tires miraculously missing his head and limbs, just tearing off a hunk of his hair. That was in the days before he was ready to admit there was a higher power keeping him alive. Uncanny how similar the after effects of the jump were to extremes of alcohol abuse. But worse, like the mother of all hangovers combined with a dose of magic mushrooms. Neither BG nor Severin had mentioned hallucinations, but maybe these guys were simply more robust than him. Or maybe they were both fast asleep right now, quietly recuperating, instead of making fools of themselves. He waited for the room to become a geometric space of fixed angles anchored in gravity, and then he got up. He checked the chute for messages. Still no word from B. Perhaps he should have asked Granger to come to his room to check his machine, make sure he was using it correctly. But it was night, and she was a woman and he barely knew her. Nor would their relationship have got off to an auspicious start if he'd hallucinated that she was sprouting multiple eyes and mouths and then collapsed at her feet. Besides, the chute was so simple to operate that he couldn't imagine how anyone, even a technophobe like himself, might misunderstand it. The thing sent and received messages, that was all. It didn't play movies, make noises, offer to sell him products, inform him about the plight of mistreated donkeys or the Brazilian rainforest. It didn't offer him the opportunity to check the weather in southern England or the current number of Christians in China or the names and dates of dynasties. It just confirmed that his messages had been sent and that there was no reply. Abruptly, he glimpsed, not on the matte grey screen of the chute, but in his own mind, a picture of tangled wreckage on an English motorway, at night, garishly lit by the headlights of emergency vehicles. B, dead, somewhere on the road between Heathrow and home. Loose pearls scattered across the asphalt, black slicks of blood. A month ago already. History. Such things could happen. One person embarks on an outrageously hazardous journey and arrives unscathed. Another goes for a short routine drive and gets killed. God's sick sense of humour, as one grieving parent, soon to leave the church, had once put it. For a few seconds, the nightmarish vision of Beatrice lying dead on the road was real to Peter, and a nauseous thrill of terror passed through his guts. But no, he mustn't let himself be deluded by imaginary horrors. God was never cruel. Life could be cruel, but not God. In a universe made dangerous by the gift of free will, God could be relied upon for support no matter what happened. And he appreciated the potentials and limitations of each of his children. Peter knew that if anything awful happened to B, there was no way he'd be able to function here. The mission would be over before it began. And if there was one thing that had become clear in all the months of thought and prayer leading up to his journey to Oasis, it was that God really wanted him here. He was safe in God's hands, and so was B. She must be. As for the chute, there was one easy way of checking whether he was using it correctly. He located the USIC icon, a stylized green scarab on the screen, and clicked open the menu behind it. It wasn't much of a menu, just three items: maintenance, repairs, admin, and Granger, obviously set up in haste by Granger herself. If he wanted a more substantial list of correspondence, it was up to him to organize it. He opened a fresh message page and wrote, "Dear Granger," then deleted "dear" and substituted "hi," then deleted that and just had "Granger," then reinstated "dear," then deleted it again. Unwarranted intimacy versus unfriendly brusqueness. A flurry of confused gestures before communication could begin. Letter writing must have been so much easier in the olden days, when everyone, even the bank manager or the tax department, was "dear." "Hi, Granger. You were right. I am tired. I should sleep some more. Sorry for any inconvenience. Best wishes, Peter." Laboriously, he undressed. Every item of his clothing was swollen with damp, like he'd been caught in a downpour. His socks peeled away from his wrinkled feet like muddy clumps of foliage. His trousers and jacket clung obstinately to him, resisting his attempts to tug free. Everything he removed weighed heavy and fell to the floor with a dull whump. At first, he thought the fragments of his clothing had actually crumbled off and rolled across the floor. But on closer inspection, the loose bits were dead insects. He picked up one of the bodies and held it between his fingers. The wings had lost their silvery translucence and were stained red with dye. Legs had been lost. It was an effort, actually, to perceive this mangled husk as an insect at all. It looked and felt like the pulverized remains of a hand-rolled cigarette. Why had these creatures hitched a ride in his clothes? He'd probably killed them just by the friction of walking. Remembering the camera, he fished it out of his jacket pocket. It was slippery with moisture. He switched it on, intending to review the pictures he'd taken of the USIC perimeter and to snap a few more here to show B his quarters, his sodden clothes, maybe one of the insects. A spark leapt from the mechanism, stinging him, and the light died. He held the camera in his hand, staring down at it as though it were a bird whose tiny heart had burst from fright. He knew the thing was unfixable, and yet he half hoped that if he waited a while, it would hiccup back into life. Just a moment ago, it had been a clever little storehouse of memories for B. A trove of images which would come to his aid in a near future he'd already inhabited in his imagination. him and B on the bed, the gadget glowing between them, her pointing, him following the line of her finger, him saying, "That? Oh, that was... and that was... and that was..." Now suddenly, none of it was. In his palm lay a small metal shape with no purpose. As the minutes passed, he became aware that his naked flesh smelled strange. It was that same faint honeydew melon scent he detected in the drinking water. The atmosphere swirling around out there had not been content merely to lick and stroke his skin. It had made him fragrant, as well as provoking copious sweat. He was too tired to wash, and a slight quaver in the straight line of the skirting board warned him that the whole room might soon start moving again if he didn't shut his eyes and rest. He collapsed on the bed and slept for an eternity which, when he awoke, turned out to have been 40-odd minutes. He checked the chute for messages. Nothing. Not even from Granger. Maybe he didn't know how to use this machine after all. The message he'd sent Granger was not a foolproof test, because he'd worded it in such a way that it hadn't strictly required a response. He thought for a minute, then wrote, "Hello again, Granger. Sorry to bother you, but I haven't noticed any phones or any other method of getting hold of somebody directly. Are there none? Best wishes, Peter." He showered, toweled himself half dry, and lay on the bed again, still naked. If his messages to Granger had failed to get through, and she turned up a few minutes from now, he would wrap himself in a sheet and talk to her through the door. Unless she walked right in without knocking. She wouldn't do that, would she? Surely the social conventions of the USIC base weren't that different from the norm. He looked around the room for a suitable object to wedge against the door, but there was nothing. Once, years ago, while going through the complicated procedure of locking up the church, deadbolts, padlocks, mortise locks, even a chain, he'd suggested to Beatrice that they should have an open door policy. "But we do," she'd said, puzzled. "No, I mean no locks at all. The door's open to anyone, any time. Entertaining angels unawares, as the scripture puts it." She'd stroked his head as if he were a child. "You're sweet." "I'm serious." "So are the drug addicts." "We don't have any drugs here. And nothing that could be sold for drugs." He gestured at the walls decorated with children's drawings, the pews with their comfy old cushions, the wobbly lectern, the stacks of well-worn Bibles, the general absence of silver candelabras, antique sculptures, and precious ornaments. B sighed. "Anything can be sold for drugs. Or at least the person can try, if he's desperate enough." And she gave him a, "You'd know all about that, wouldn't you?" look. Indeed, he knew all about that. He just had a tendency to forget. Despite his resolution to stay awake until the time Granger might show up if she hadn't received his message, Peter fell asleep. 2 hours passed, and when he woke, the room was stable, and the view through the window was unchanged. Lonesome expanses of darkness, speckled with eerie lamplight. He shambled out of bed, and his foot kicked something flimsy across the floor. One of his socks, dried out and stiff, transformed from cotton into cardboard. He sat at the chute and read a fresh response from Granger that had his own "sorry to bother you" lure hanging off it. "A telephone call would have bothered me a lot more," she wrote, "especially if I'd been asleep. No, there are no phones. USIC tried setting them up in the early days, but reception ranged from lousy to non-existent. The atmosphere is wrong, too thick or something. So, we've done without. And it's been okay. Let's face it, most of what phones get used for is a total waste of time anyway. We've got red buttons all over the place for emergencies, and never need them. Our work schedules are on printed rosters, so we know where to turn up and what to do. As far as chat goes, we talk face to face if we're not too busy. And if we're too busy, we shouldn't be trying to chat. When special announcements need to be made, we pipe them over the PA. We can use the chute also, but most people wait until they can discuss things face to face. Everybody's an expert here, and discussions can get quite technical. And then there's the give and take of problem solving in situ. Writing stuff down so as the other person can understand it, and then waiting for an answer is a nightmare. Hope this helps. Granger."
He smiled. In one sentence, she'd flushed thousands of years of written communication briskly down the toilet, having already discarded a century and a half of telephone use in the previous dump. The hope this helps Chaser was a cute touch too. Chutzpah of a kind. Still smiling and picturing the boyish face of Granger in his head, he checked for messages from Beatrice, not really expecting any. A long scroll of text manifested on the screen, and because it appeared instantaneously, without fuss or fanfare, he was slow to recognize it for what it was. The screen was full to overflowing. He looked into the nest of words and spotted the name Joshua. A cluster of six letters, meaningless to most other people, but it sprang into his soul and made it come alive with vivid images. Joshua's paws, with their comical white tufts between the pink pads. Joshua covered in plaster dust from next door's renovations. Joshua performing his death-defying circus leap from the top of the fridge to the ironing board. Joshua scratching at the kitchen window, his soft cry inaudible over the peak hour traffic. Joshua asleep in the basket of dried washing. Joshua on the kitchen table, stroking his furry jaw against the earthenware teapot that never got used for any other purpose than this. Joshua in bed with him and B. And then he saw B. B only half covered by the yellow duvet, reluctant to move because the cat was asleep against her thigh. B's ribcage and bosom, poking through the threadbare cotton of her favorite t-shirt, which was too old to be worn in public anymore, but which was just right for bed. B's neck, long and smooth except for two pale creases like seams. B's mouth, her lips. Dear Peter, her letter began. Oh, the preciousness to him of those words. If there'd been no more to her message than this, he would have been satisfied. He would have read, Dear Peter, Dear Peter, Dear Peter, over and over, not out of vanity, but because these were words from her to him. Dear Peter, I'm crying with relief as I write this. Knowing that you're alive has made me all shaky and woozy, as if I've been holding my breath for a month and I've finally let it out. Praise the Lord that he kept you safe. What's it like where you are? I don't mean the room. I mean outside, the whole place in general. Please tell me. I'm desperate to know. Have you taken any pictures? As for me, relax. I haven't aged 50 years or even developed any wrinkles since you last saw me. Just some bags under my eyes from lack of sleep. More about that later. Seriously, the last 4 weeks have been hard. Not knowing if you would get there in one piece, or if you were already dead and nobody told me. I kept loitering around this machine, even though I knew that nothing would come through for ages yet. Then, when your message finally did come, I wasn't here to receive it. I was trapped at work. I did a morning shift which went okay, and I was about to go home, but by 2:45 it was clear we would be three staff members down. Leah and Owen phoned in sick, and Susanna just didn't turn up. No Joy from the nursing agency, so I was asked to stay on and do a double, which I did. Then, at 11 p.m, guess what? Half the night staff didn't show up either. So I was pressured to do a triple shift. Highly illegal, but do they care? Tony from next door popped round to feed Joshua, but didn't sound too happy when I phoned him. We've all got problems, he said. All the more reason to help each other, I almost said. But he sounded stressed out. If this happens again, I may have to ask the students on the other side. I probably have to teach them how to use a tin opener. Speaking of Joshua, he isn't coping well with your absence. He wakes me up at 4 a.m, meowing in my ear, and then flopping down demonstratively on your side of the bed. Then I lie awake until I have to get ready for work. Oh, the joys of being an abandoned mother. I've been checking the news on my phone obsessively, in case there was a news report about you. I know that's daft. USIC is not exactly the world's most high-profile organization, is it? We'd never even heard of them before they approached you. But still. Anyway, you're safe now. I'm so indescribably relieved. I've finally stopped trembling and I feel less woozy. I've read and reread your two messages over and over. And yes, you're right to assume that it's better to write to me when your brain is scrambled than not to write at all. Perfection is not ours to achieve. Which reminds me, please stop worrying about the last time we made love. I told you it was all right, and it was, and it is. The orgasm wasn't primarily what I wanted from the experience. Trust me. Also,
Stop worrying about what these guys, Severin, etc., think of you. It's irrelevant. You didn't go to Oasis to impress them. You went to Oasis to witness to souls who have never heard of Jesus. In any case, these USIT guys have jobs to do, and you'll probably not see much of them. I can't really picture the Oasis rain from your description, but green water sounds a bit alarming. The weather here has been terrible since you left. Heavy downpours every day. I wouldn't say it's like bead curtains, more like getting a bucket of water emptied over your head. There's been flooding in some towns in the Midlands, cars floating down the street, etc. We're okay, except that the toilet bowl is slow to drain after a flush. Ditto the plug hole in the shower cubicle. Not sure what's going on there. Too busy to get it seen to. Life in our parish continues hectic. The situation with Mira, spell it M-E-E-R-A-H, and her husband has reached crisis point. She finally told him she's been attending our church and he hit the roof. Or to be more precise, he hit Mira many times. Her face is a swollen mess. She can barely see. She says she wants to leave him and she needs my help with the legalities, housing, employment, benefits, etc. I've been making some preliminary phone calls, i.e. a few hours so far, but mainly just providing TLC. Her prospects for independence are not good. She can barely speak English. She's totally unskilled. And to be honest, I think she's of below average intelligence. I see my role as being there for her emotionally until her face heals a bit and she goes back to her husband. In the meantime, I hope our house doesn't become the scene of an Arabic honour killing. I'm sure that would traumatise Joshua no end. I know I sound flippant, but the bottom line is that I don't think Mira, M-I-R-A-H, I'll have to get the spelling straight if I'm to be filling in application forms for crisis loans, etc., is ready to receive the support and strength she would get if she gave her heart to Christ. I think she's attracted to the friendly, tolerant atmosphere of our church and the tantalizing notion of being a free woman. She talks about being a Christian as if it's a gym club membership you can sign up for. Well, I see that it's about 1:30 a.m, which is bad news for me because Joshua will no doubt wake me 2.5 hours from now and I'm not even in bed yet. I hear rain again. I love you and miss you. Don't worry about anything. Trust in Jesus. He has made the journey with you. I only wish I had. Remember that Jesus is working through you even at those times when you feel you're out of your depth. As for our old friend St. Paul, he might not approve of how much I wish I could curl up in bed next to you right now. But yes, let's quote his wise advice on other matters. My darling, we both know that the effects of your travels will eventually pass, and you'll be rested, and then you'll no longer be able to sit in your cozy quarters, writing epistles to me and looking out at the rain. You'll have to open the door and start work. As Paul says, walk in wisdom toward them that are without, redeeming the time. And remember, I'm thinking of you. Kisses, hugs, and a headbutt from Joshua. Beatrice. Peter read this letter 8 or 9 times at least, before he could bear to part with it. Then he fetched his bag, the one that the Virgin check-in girl had doubted was enough for a one-way transatlantic flight, dumped it on the bed, and zipped it open. It was time to get dressed for work. Apart from his Bible, notepads, a second pair of jeans, polished black shoes, trainers, sandals, 3 t-shirts, and 3 pairs of socks and underpants, the bag contained one item of apparel that had seemed uselessly exotic when he'd packed it. An item he'd figured he was about as likely to wear as a tutu or a tuxedo. The USIC interviewers had advised him that there was no particular dress code on Oasis, but that if he intended to spend a significant amount of time outdoors, he might wish to invest in some Arabic-style garments. Indeed, they'd dropped strong hints that he might regret it if he didn't. So Beatrice had bought him a dish dasha from the local cut-price Muslim outfitters. It was the plainest one I could find, she said, showing it to him a couple of nights before his departure. They had ones with gold brocade, spangles, embroidery. He held it against his body. It's very long, he said. It means you won't need trousers, she said, half smiling. You can be naked underneath, if you want. He thanked her, but didn't try it on. You don't think it's too girly, do you? She said. I think it's very masculine.
It's fine, he said, packing it away. It wasn't effeminacy that worried him. It was that he couldn't imagine himself swanning about like an actor in an old Bible movie. It seemed vainglorious, and not at all what modern Christianity was about. One walk in the Oasis atmosphere had changed all that. His denim jacket, still in a crumpled heap on the floor, had dried stiff as tarpaulin. An Arabic smock and pyjama-style pants, such as he'd seen several of the USIC staff wearing, was probably the ideal alternative. But his ankle-length dishdasha would do nicely too. He could wear it with sandals. So what if he looked like a fancy-dress party chic? This was about practicality. He pulled the dishdasha out of the bag, let it unfurl. To his dismay, it was spattered and stained with black ink. The ballpoint pens that had exploded during the flight had splurted their contents directly onto the white fabric. To make matters worse, it evidently scrunched the garment further down in the bag when he was preparing to leave the ship, causing the ink stains to reproduce themselves in Rorschach fashion. And yet, he shook the garment straight, held it at arm's length. Something astonishing had happened. The ink pattern, created randomly, had turned into a cross. A Christian cross, right in the middle of the chest. If it had been red instead of black, it would almost be the insignia on the tunic of a medieval crusader. Almost. The ink stains were untidy, with globs and stray extra lines marring the perfection of the design. Although, those faint lines ghosting under the crossbar could be interpreted as the skeletally thin arms of the crucified Christ. And those spiky smudges higher up could be seen as thorns from Jesus's crown. He shook his head. Reading too much into things was a weakness of his. And yet here it was, the cross on his garment where no cross was before. He prodded the ink to check if it stained his fingers. Apart from a slightly tacky patch in the very center, it was dry, ready to wear. He threw the dishdasha over his head and allowed the cool fabric to slide across his skin, sheathing his nakedness. Turning to appraise his reflection in the window, he confirmed that B had chosen well. The thing fitted him as though a tailor in the Middle East had measured his shoulders, cut the cloth, and sewn it for him specially. The window he'd been using as a mirror became a window again as lights flared up outside. Two glowing points, like the eyes of some monstrous organism approaching. He stepped closer to the glass and peered through, but the vehicle's headlights disappeared just as he recognized them for what they were. Chapter 6. His whole life had been leading up to this. A rendezvous between a married man and a female stranger, each of them far from home, in the obscure hours before dawn. If there was anything improper or potentially complicated about that, Peter didn't waste energy worrying over it. He and Granger both had jobs to do, and God was watching. Besides, Granger's reaction to him when he opened the door to her knock was hardly encouraging. She did a double take, a classic cartoon-style double take. Her head jerked so hard he thought she might teeter backward into the corridor, but she just swayed on her feet instead. The provocation, of course, was the big inky cross on his chest. Seeing it through her eyes, he was suddenly embarrassed. "I took your advice," he tried to joke, plucking at the sleeves of the dishdasha. "About the denim jacket." She didn't smile. Just stared some more. "You could have gone to, like, a t-shirt place," she said at last, "and got that done, professionally." Her own attire was unchanged since their first meeting. Still the white smock, cotton slacks and headscarf. Not conventional Western dress by any means, yet somehow, on her, it looked more natural, less affected, than his own get-up. "The cross was an accident," he explained. "A bunch of ink pens exploded." Okay, she said. "Well, I guess it gives kind of a homespun impression. Amateur. In a good way." This condescending gesture of diplomacy made him smile. "You think I look like a ponce?" "A what?" "A poser."
She glanced down the corridor toward the exit. Not for me to say. You ready? Side by side, they walked out of the building into the darkness. The warm air embraced them with balmy enthusiasm, and Peter instantly felt less self-conscious about his outfit, as it was perfect for the climate. Transporting his old clothes all the way to Oasis had been pointless. He appreciated that now. He must reinvent himself, and this morning was a good time to begin. Granger's vehicle was parked right next to the compound, illuminated by a lamp jutting from the concrete facade. It was a big military-looking thing, clearly much more powerful than the frugal little runabout Peter and Bea owned. I really appreciate you making a car available for me, said Peter. I imagine you have to ration them, the fuel and so on. Best to keep them in use, said Granger. They go to hell otherwise, technically speaking. The moisture is a killer. Let me show you something. She stepped up to the vehicle and flipped open the hatch to show him the engine. Peter dutifully leaned over and looked, although he knew nothing about the inner workings of cars, hadn't even mastered such basics as Bea could manage, like topping up oil, applying antifreeze, or attaching jump leads. Even so, he could tell that there was something unusual here. It's disgusting, he said, and laughed at his own tactlessness. But it was true. The whole engine was caked in a greasy gunk that stank like old cat food. Sure, said Granger, but I hope you understand this isn't damage. This is the cure, the prevention. Oh. She pushed the hatch down with just the right amount of force to make it snap shut. Takes a full hour to grease up a vehicle like this. Do a few of them, and you stink for the whole day. Instinctively, he tried to smell her, or at least retrieve a memory of how she'd smelled before they stepped out into the muggy air. She smelled neutral. Nice, even. Is that one of your jobs? Greasing up the cars? She motioned him to get in. We all get grease duty sometimes. Very democratic. Nobody complains? This is not the place for complainers, she said, swinging into the driver's seat. He opened the passenger door and joined her inside. No sooner had his body settled into position than she switched on the ignition and got the motor revving. What about the people at the top, he asked. Do they get grease duty too? People at the top? The, administration, managers, whatever you call them here. Granger blinked, as though she'd been asked a question about lion tamers or circus clowns. We don't really have managers, she said, as she steered the vehicle and got into gear. We all pitch in, take turns. It's pretty obvious what needs to be done. If there's any disagreement, we vote. Mostly, we just follow the USIC guidelines. Sounds too good to be true. Too good to be true? Granger shook her head. No offense, but that's what some people might say about religion. Not about a simple duty roster for keeping your vehicle's engines from corroding. The rhetoric was neat, but something in Granger's tone of voice made Peter suspect that she didn't quite believe it. He had a pretty good radar for the doubts that people hid beneath bravado. But there must be someone, he insisted, who takes responsibility for the project as a whole. Sure, she said. The car was picking up speed now, and the lights of the compound rapidly receded into the gloom. But they're a long way away. Can't expect them to hold our hands, can we? As they drove through the dark toward the invisible horizon, they munched on raisin bread. Granger had positioned a big, fresh loaf of it in the gap between the front seats, propped up against the gear stick, and they each helped themselves to slice after slice. This is good, he said. It's made here, she said, with a hint of pride. Including the raisins? No, not the raisins, or the egg, but the flour and the shortening and the sweetener and the sodium bicarbonate are. And the loaves are baked here. We have a bakery. Very nice. He munched some more, swallowed. They'd left the base perimeter 15 minutes ago. Nothing remarkable had happened yet. There was little to be seen in the vehicle's headlight beam, which was the only light for miles around. Not for the first time, Peter thought about how much of our lives we spend sequestered inside small patches of electric brightness, blind to everything beyond the reach of those fragile bulbs. When is sunrise? He asked.
In about 3-4 hours, she said. Or maybe 2. I'm not sure. Don't quote me. It's a gradual process. Not so dramatic. They were driving straight over raw, uncultivated ground. There was no road or track or any evidence that anyone had ever driven or walked here before, although Granger assured him that she made this trip regularly. In the absence of tracks or lights, it was sometimes difficult to believe they were moving, despite the gentle vibration of the vehicle's chassis. The view in every direction was the same. Granger would occasionally glance at the dashboard's computerized navigation system, which kept her informed when they were about to stray from the correct course. The landscape, what little Peter could see of it in the dark, was surprisingly bare given the climate. The earth was chocolate brown and so densely compacted that the tires traveled smoothly across it with no jolt to the suspension. Here and there, the terrain was spotted with patches of white mushroom, or speckled with a haze of greenish stuff that might be moss. No trees, no bushes, not even any grass. A dark, moist tundra. He took another slice of raisin bread. It was losing its appeal, but he was hungry. I wouldn't have thought, he remarked, that eggs could survive the jump intact. I certainly felt a bit scrambled myself when I went through it. Egg powder, said Granger. We use egg powder. Of course. Through the side window, he spotted a single swirl of rain in an otherwise vacant sky. A curved glitter of water drops, about the size of a Ferris wheel, making its way across the land. It was traveling at a different tangent from their own, so Granger would have to detour in order to drive through it. He considered asking her if they could do so for the fun of it, like children chasing a rotating garden sprinkler. But she was intent on her navigation, staring out at the non-road ahead, both hands clamped on the steering wheel. The shimmering rain swirl dimmed as the headlight beams passed it by, and then was swept into the darkness of their wake. So, said Peter, tell me what you know. About what? Her relaxed demeanor was gone in a flash. About the people we're going to see. They're not people. Well, he drew a deep breath. Here's an idea, Granger. How about we agree to use the term people in its extended sense of inhabitants? The original Roman etymology isn't clear, so who knows? Maybe it meant inhabitants anyway. Of course, we could use creature instead, but there are problems with that, don't you think? I mean, personally, I'd love to use creature if we could just take it back to its Latin origins. Creatura, created thing. Because we're all created things, aren't we? But it's suffered a bit of a decline, that word, through the centuries, to the point where creature to most people means monster, or at least animal. Which reminds me, wouldn't it be nice to use animal for all beings that breathe? After all, the Greek word anima means breath or soul, which pretty much covers everything we're looking for, doesn't it? Silence settled in the cabin. Granger drove, keeping her eyes straight on the headlight beam just as before. After 30 seconds or so, which seemed quite a long time in the circumstances, she said, Well, it's plain to see you're not an uneducated holy roller from Hicksville. I never said I was. She glanced aside at him, caught him smiling, smiled back. Tell me, Peter, what made you decide to come here and do this? I didn't decide, he said. God did. He sent you an email? Sure. He grinned wider. You wake up in the morning, go to the inbox of your heart, check what's loaded in. Sometimes there's a message. That's kind of a corny way of putting it. He stopped smiling, not because he was offended, but because the discussion was turning serious. Most true things are kind of corny, don't you think? But we make them more sophisticated out of sheer embarrassment. Simple truths with complicated clothes on. The only purpose of the linguistic dressing up is so people won't look at the contents of our naked hearts and minds and say, How naff? She frowned. Naff? It's a British slang term, meaning trite or banal, but with an extra overtone of, nerdishness, uncoolness, dorkishness. Wow. Did they teach American slang in your Bible school too? Peter took a few swigs from a water bottle. I never went to Bible school. I went to the University of Hard Drinking and Drug Abuse, got my degree in toilet bowl interior decoration, and, hospital casualty ward occupancy. And then you found God? Then I found a woman called Beatrice. We fell in love. Guys don't often put it that way. What do you mean? Guys say, we got together, or you can guess the rest, or something like that. Something that doesn't sound quite so... naff? Exactly. Well, we fell in love, said Peter. I quit the booze and drugs to impress her. I hope she was impressed. Yes. He took a last swig, screwed the top back on the bottle, and slid it onto the floor between his feet. Although she didn't tell me so until years later. Addicts don't handle praise well. The pressure of living up to it drives them back to drink and drugs. Yep. Have you had some experience of these things in your life? Yep. Do you want to talk about it? Not right now. She readjusted her posture in the seat, revved the engine, drove a little faster. The blush on her face made her look more feminine, although it accentuated the white scar under her hairline. She had pulled off her headscarf so that it hung loosely around her neck. Her short crop of soft mousy hair fluttered in the air conditioning. Your girlfriend sounds like a smart cookie. She's my wife, and yes, she's smart. Smarter, or at least wiser than I am, that's for sure. Then why was it you that got chosen for this mission? Peter rested his head against the seat. I've wondered about that myself. I suppose God must have other plans for Beatrice at home. Granger didn't comment. Peter looked out the side window. The sky was a little lighter. Perhaps he was only imagining it. A particularly large clump of mushrooms trembled as they swept by. You didn't answer my question, he said. I told you I didn't want to talk about it, she said. No, I meant my question about the people we're going to see. What do you know about them? They're... She struggled for several seconds to find the right words. They like their privacy. I could have guessed that. Not a single photo in any of the brochures and reports USIC gave me. I was expecting at least one smiley picture of your top bra shaking hands with the locals. She chuckled. That would be difficult to arrange. No hands? Sure they have hands. They just don't like to be touched. So, describe them. It's difficult, she sighed. I'm not good at descriptions. We'll see them soon enough. Do try. He batted his eyelashes. I'd appreciate it. Well, they wear long robes and hoods. Like monks, I guess. So, they're human in shape. I guess it's kind of hard to tell. But they have two arms, two legs, a torso. Sure. He shook his head. That surprises me. All along I've been telling myself I mustn't assume the human design is some sort of universal standard. So I was trying to imagine... big spider-like things, or eyes on stalks, or giant hairless possums. Giant hairless possums? She beamed. I love it. Very sci-fi. But why should they have human form, Granger? Of all the forms they might conceivably have, isn't that exactly what you'd expect from sci-fi? Yeah, I guess. Or religion, maybe. Didn't God create man in his own image? I wouldn't use the word man. The Hebrew is ha-adam, which I would argue encompasses both sexes. Pleased to hear it, she said, deadpan. Again, they drove on for a couple of minutes in silence. On the horizon, Peter was certain he could see the beginnings of a glow, a subtle haze of illumination, turning the junction of sky and earth from dark aquamarine against black to green against brown. If you stared at it too long, you began to wonder whether it was just an optical illusion, a hallucination, a frustrated yearning for the end of night. And inside that hesitant glow, was that? Yes, there was something else on the horizon. Raised structures of some sort. Mountains? Boulders? Buildings? A town? A city? Granger had said that the settlement was about 50 miles away.
They must have travelled half that distance by now, surely. Do they have genders? He said at last. Who? She said. The people we're going to see. Granger looked exasperated. Why don't you just come straight out and use the word aliens? Because we're the aliens here. She laughed out loud. I love it. A politically correct missionary. Forgive me for saying so, but it seems a total contradiction in terms. I forgive you, Granger, he winked. And my attitude shouldn't strike you as a contradiction. God loves every creature equally. The smile faded from her face. None in my experience, she said. Silence descended on the cabin once more. Peter deliberated whether to push, decided not to. Not in that direction, anyway. Not yet. So, he rejoined lightly, do they have genders? I have no idea, said Granger in a flat, businesslike tone. You'll have to lift up their robes and take a look. They drove for 10-15 minutes without further conversation. The topmost slice of the raisin bread dried out. The haze of light on the horizon became more distinct. The mysterious structures straight ahead were definitely architecture of some kind, although the sky was still too dark for Peter to make out exact shapes or details. Eventually he said, I need to have a pee. No problem, said Granger, and slowed the car to a halt. On the dashboard, an electronic gauge estimating the fuel consumption per mile flickered through its numbers and settled on an abstract symbol. Peter opened the door, and as he stepped out onto the earth, was enveloped at once by the humid, whispering air. He'd grown unaccustomed to it, having spent so long in the air-conditioned bubble of the vehicle. It was enjoyable, this sudden, all-out luxury of atmosphere, but also an assault. The way the air immediately ran up the sleeves of his shirt, licked his eyelids and ears, dampened his chest. He hitched the hem of his dish dasher up to his abdomen and pissed straight onto the ground, since the landscape offered no trees or boulders to hide behind. The earth was already moist and dark brown, so the urine made little difference to its colour or consistency. It sank in without pause. He heard Granger opening and shutting the door on her side of the vehicle. To give her some privacy, he stood for a while and appraised the scenery. The plants that he'd taken for mushrooms were flowers, greyish-white flowers with a tinge of mauve, almost luminous in the gloom. They grew in small, neat clumps. There was no distinction between blossom, leaf, and stalk. The whole plant was slightly furry, leathery, and yet so thin as to be almost transparent, like the ear of a kitten. Evidently, no other plants were viable in this part of the world. Or perhaps it'd simply come at the wrong time of year. Granger's door slammed, and he turned to join her. She was crumpling a cardboard box of disposable tissues into the glove compartment as he took his seat. Okay, she said. Last few miles coming up. He shut his door, and the air conditioning promptly restored the neutral atmosphere of the cabin. Peter settled back in his seat and shivered as a trapped wisp of balmy oasis air slipped between his shoulder blades and out of his collar. I must say, you built your landing base a respectfully long way out, he said. The planners of London's airports were never so considerate of local residents. Granger unscrewed a water bottle, drank deep, coughed. A rivulet ran down her chin, and she mopped it up with a handful of her headscarf. Actually, she cleared her throat. Actually, when we first built the base, the local residents lived just 2 miles away. They relocated, took everything with them. I mean, everything. A couple of our guys had a look around the old settlement when it was all over. Like, maybe we can learn something from what they left behind, but it was stripped clean. Just the shells of houses, not even a single mushroom left in the ground. She consulted one of the gauges on the dashboard. The 50 miles must have taken them forever to walk. It sounds like they really do value their privacy, unless... He hesitated, trying to think of a diplomatic way of asking whether Usyk had done something outrageously offensive. Before he could frame the question, Granger answered it. It was out of the blue. They just told us they were moving. We asked if we were doing anything wrong, like, was there some problem we could fix so they'd reconsider? They said, no, no problem. Granger revved the engine, and they were off again. When you say we asked, said Peter, do you mean we, as in... I wasn't personally a party to these negotiations, no.
Do you speak their language?
No.
Not a word?
Not a word.
So, how good is their English? I mean, I tried to find out about this before I came, but I couldn't get a straight answer.
There isn't a straight answer. Some of them, maybe most of them, don't...
Her voice trailed off. She chewed her lip.
Listen, this is going to sound bad. It's not meant to. The thing is, we don't know how many of them there are. Partly because they keep themselves hidden, and partly because we can't tell the difference between them.
No disrespect, but we just can't.
There's a few individuals we have dealings with. Maybe a dozen. Or maybe it's the same five or six guys in different clothes. We just can't tell.
They speak some English.
Enough.
Who taught them?
I think they just kind of picked it up. I don't know.
She glanced up at the rearview mirror, as though there might be a traffic snarl he was distracting her from dealing with safely.
You'd have to ask Tartaglione if he was still with us.
Sorry?
Tartaglione was a linguist. He came here to study the language. He was going to compile a dictionary and so forth, but he... disappeared.
Peter chewed on that for a couple of seconds.
Right, he said. You do drop lots of little morsels of info, don't you? If only I wait long enough.
She sighed, annoyed again.
I already told you most of this stuff when I first met you, escorting you off the ship.
This was news to him. He strained to recall their walk together on that first day. The words had evaporated. All he recalled vaguely was her presence at his side.
Forgive me. I was very tired.
You're forgiven.
They traveled on. A few hundred meters ahead and to the side of them, there was another isolated swirl of rain, cartwheeling along the land.
Can we drive through that? Peter asked.
Sure.
She swerved slightly, and they plowed through the whirl of brilliant water drops, which enveloped them momentarily in its fairy-like display.
Psychedelic, huh?
Remarked Granger, deadpan switching on the windscreen wipers.
Beautiful, he said.
After another few minutes of driving, the shapes on the horizon had firmed up into the unmistakable contours of buildings. Nothing fancy or monumental. Square blocks, like British tower blocks. Cheap utilitarian housing. Not exactly the diamantine spires of a fantastical city.
What do they call themselves? Asked Peter.
I've no idea, said Granger. Something we couldn't pronounce, I guess.
So who named this place Oasis?
A little girl from Oskaloosa, Iowa.
You're kidding.
She cast him a bemused glance.
You didn't read about it? It's got to be the only thing the average person knows about this place. There were articles about this little girl in magazines. She was on TV.
I don't read magazines, and I don't have a TV.
Now it was her turn to say, you're kidding.
He smiled. I'm not kidding. One day I got a message from the Lord saying, get rid of the TV, Peter. It's a huge waste of time. So I did.
She shook her head. I don't know how to take you.
Straight, he said. Always straight. Anyway, this little girl from Oskaloosa. She won a competition. Name a New World.
I'm so amazed you didn't hear about it.
There were hundreds of thousands of entries, most of them unbelievably wrong. It was like a nerd jamboree. The USIC staff in the building where I worked kept an internal dossier of the worst names. Every week we'd have new favorites. We ended up using them for a competition we ran ourselves to name the janitor's supply room. Nouveau Opportunus. That was a great one. Zion 2. Atlanto.
Arnold. That had real pizzazz, I thought.
Splendoramus. Einsteinia. I forget the rest.
Oh, yeah. Traveler's Rest. That was another one. Newfound Planet. Cervix. Hendrix. Alvis.
They just kept on coming.
And the little girl?
She got lucky, I guess. There must have been hundreds of other people who came up with Oasis. She won $50,000. The family needed it, too.
because the mother had just lost her job and the father had been diagnosed with some kind of rare disease. So how did the story end? Just like you'd expect. The dad died. The mom talked about it on TV and became an alcoholic. Then the media moved on and you never got to know what happened next. Can you remember the girl's name? I'd like to pray for her. Granger butted her palms against the steering wheel irritably and rolled her eyes upward. Please. There were a million Americans praying for her and it didn't stop her life going down the toilet. He shut up, face front. They drove in silence for 40 seconds or so. Coretta, she said at last. Thank you, said Peter. He tried to picture Coretta, so that she wouldn't be just a name to him when he prayed. Any sort of face was better than none at all. He thought of the children he knew, the kids in his congregation back home, but the ones that sprang to mind were too old or too young or the wrong sex. In any case, as a minister in his own church, he wasn't so involved with the little ones. B took them into another room for play activities during his sermons. Not that he was unaware of them while he preached. The walls were so thin that if he paused for effect between sentences, the silence was often filled by laughter, or snatches of song, or even the galumphing of small feet. But he didn't know any of the kids particularly well. This Coretta, he said, pushing his luck with Granger. Is she black or white? One child had popped into his memory. The daughter of that new Somali couple, the cheeky girl who was always dressed like a miniature 19th century Southern belle. What was her name? Lulu. Adorable kid. White, said Granger. Blonde hair. Or maybe a redhead, I forget. It was a long time ago, and there's no way of checking. Can't you look her up? She blinked. Look her up? On a computer or something? Even as he said it, he realized it was a stupid suggestion. Oasis was far beyond the reach of any information superhighways. There were no worldwide webs laden with morsels of trivia, no industrious search engines offering up millions of Oskaloosas and Corettas. If what you wanted to know was not to be found in the stuff you brought along with you, the books, the magic discs, the memory sticks, the old copies of Hydraulics magazine, you could forget it. Sorry, he said, not thinking clearly. This atmosphere will do that to you, she said. I hate the way it pushes. Right inside your ears, even. Never lets up. Sometimes you just want to... She didn't pursue the thought, just puffed a mouthful of breath upward, dislodging a damp lock of hair from her forehead. There's no point talking about it with the guys here. They're used to it. They don't have a problem with it. They don't notice it anymore. Maybe they even enjoy it. Maybe they hate it, but don't complain. Her face went stiff. Okay. Message received, she said. Peter groaned inwardly. He should have thought the implications through before opening his mouth. What was wrong with him today? He was usually so tactful. Could it be the atmosphere, as Granger said? He'd always imagined his brain as a wholly enclosed thing, safe inside a shell of bone. But maybe, in this strange new environment, the seal was more permeable, and his brain was being infiltrated by insidious vapors. He wiped sweat off his eyelids and made an effort to be 100% alert, facing front and peering through the dirt-haze windscreen. The terrain was looser, less stable the closer they came to their destination. Particles of clammy soil were being thrown up by the tires and enveloping the vehicle in a kind of halo of filth. The outline of the native settlement seemed grim and unwelcoming somehow. Suddenly, the magnitude of the challenge hit home. Until now, it had been all about him and his ability to keep himself in one piece, to survive the journey, to recover from the jump, to adjust to the strange new air and the shock of separation. But there was so much more to it than that. The scale of the unknown remained just as immense, whether he was feeling well or unwell. He was approaching monolithic barriers of foreignness, which existed oblivious to him. Indifferent to how rested or unrested he was, how bleary-eyed or attentive, how keen or dull. Psalm 139 came to his mind, as it so often did when he needed reassurance. But today, the reminder of God's omniscience was no comfort.
Instead, it heightened his own sense of unease. How precious are thy thoughts unto me, O God! How great is the sum of them! If I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. Each and every mote of dirt flung up by the vehicle's wheels was like a truth that he needed to learn, a ridiculously large number of truths which he had neither the time nor the wisdom to grasp. He was not God, and maybe only God could do what needed to be done here. Granger switched on the windscreen wipers once more. The view went smeary for a while, then the glass cleared and the native settlement was revealed afresh, lit up now by the rising sun. The sun made all the difference. Yes, the mission was daunting, and yes, he wasn't in the best shape. But here he was, on the threshold of meeting an entirely new kind of people, an encounter chosen for him by God. Whatever was fated to happen, it would surely be precious and amazing. His whole life. He understood that now, as the facades of the unknown city loomed up before him, harboring unimaginable wonders. His whole life had been leading up to this.